Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm so happy you're listening. I am Taryn Armstrong. I am a podcaster. I specialize in talking about shows like Big Brother and Survivor and the games that are played on those shows, the social strategy games in particular. The idea behind these games are that players go into a house or on an island and they compete with one another and vote each other out until there are just a few left standing at the end. And then the people that were voted out go and they vote for the winner who played the best. And that's how these games work. And ever since I was a kid, they have endlessly fascinated me in terms of the social dynamics, the strategies, the game theory, the psychology behind it. Every aspect of it has always been super interesting to me. And so in this time where we are without these shows for who knows how long, I decided that it would be fun to do some off-season content and really just explore the game side of the shows, or really all sides of the show. But the social strategy element in particular, I want to examine different elements of what goes into these kinds of games, what kinds of things that you can learn from them, examine the different players, how they played, talk about, you know, who's played the best, who's played the worst, all sorts of different elements that we can really examine in Survivor, Big Brother. Big Brother in particular is really where I specialized. It's where we have the most amount of information. But Survivor can be relevant at times as well. So I don't want to exclude it from the discussion. And there are, of course, other, you know, any social strategy concept, game, whatever, is, I think, fair game for this podcast. So that's what this series of podcasts is going to be. Hopefully you guys enjoy it. And I don't know. We'll have some fun. It'll sometimes just be me because I'm examining something in detail and it's going to be a little more produced. Sometimes it'll be more of like a panel, and we'll just have some people on the panel, and we'll talk about a topic, or we'll rank something or something along those lines. But over the course of this series, hopefully you have a good time, and or maybe you learn something, or maybe I learn something. Maybe we all learn something along the way, and that it's that friendship is all that matters between everyone. All right. So for this first podcast, I wanted to look at Big Brother in particular. I am the Big Brother guy. I've watched for a very long time. I've watched every season multiple times. I've studied the game. There are a lot of different ideas and topics that I've had on my mind about strategy in Big Brother. In particular, what I want to look at for this podcast is the development of alliance structure over the course of Big Brother history. If that doesn't make sense to you right now, hopefully I can explain it as we go. So basically, Big Brother is a game where you vote people out, right? You vote people out until you get to the end. That's the real like strategy portion of the game. Of course, you also need to win once you get to the end. There's some strategy to that as well, but it's a little bit different. It's incorporated into what you're doing across the game. But the very basic premise of Big Brother, the simplest element of a show, of a game where you have to vote each other out with votes, which means you need to get a majority of votes on any one particular thing, is that you make an alliance. Alliances, the very basic foundation of any social strategy game, really, is that you work with other people to accomplish a task. Trying to do something on your own when you're talking about votes, it's just not going to work very well. That's just the nature of how voting works in a social game like this. So alliances are really the basic building block of any strategy in a social strategy game, in particular in Big Brother. Alliance structure has been an incredibly important aspect of Big Brother strategy since the beginning. If you think of every single great player that you consider to be a great player of the game, they have all implemented some form of what we're going to be talking about in this podcast. And they're the ones that tend to have implemented it the best. There will be spoilers for every single Big Brother season, US and even a little bit Canadian at the end. So just be prepared for that. So I do want to quickly throw a disclaimer that this is not meant to be a comprehensive history of Big Brother. I'm trying to examine one concept in the show and sort of get a through line through the history of the show. And so with that in mind, there will be things that I skip that I'm not going to be touching on every detail. And there may be things that I simplify in order to prevent us from getting bogged down too much in the details. So if you are missing something or you feel like I didn't completely accurately represent all the details of a particular situation, please know that this was part of my attempt to make this as concise and clear and easy to understand as possible. And hopefully we did it all right. But let's get into it. So season two is where we see the first elements of strategy start to emerge on Big Brother. And really, you see almost all of the basic building blocks of strategy that you will see for the rest of Big Brother's history emerge in season two. All of the basics are there because so many of them are so natural to playing this kind of game. There's kind of like two different ways that you can look at strategy. One of them is that when you play a game with other people, your natural instincts are going to point you in a certain direction. They're going to have you teaming up with your friends. They're going to have you, trying to take out people that you don't like, people that you think will come at you. There are just very basic elements that you will naturally move toward in a game. And then if you study the game, you might start to figure out some of the more complicated structures and strategies that will have you succeed a little more in the show. So in season two, we see many of these natural inclinations and even some higher level strategies already emerging. It doesn't take long for these things to come out into the open, and we get to see a lot of them. So obviously the first and most basic, forming alliances, that we immediately see that alliances start to form. On Survivor, this was a taboo concept almost, that they didn't want to make alliances, and only a couple people really did, and those people ended up winning or getting very far. No such problem on Big Brother. I think it in part was helped by the fact that it came on after season one of Survivor, and so that taboo was demystified a little bit at the very least. But alliance is definitely coming into play right away on season two.
I think people are still getting to know each other, but I also think that people may be forming alliances. That's just natural because that's part of the game.
That was Monica on episode one of season two of Big Brother. Alliances are just part of the game. They're just naturally occurring. We're then going to see that a few alliances are proposed, and eventually we're going to get to the point where two alliances are formed in season two. Two very early alliances, Chilltown and Top, the other people. So the Chilltown was, they were just people that hung out. They were friends. They were in the same room together. And then Top, the other people, was formed as a counter alliance to Chilltown. Chilltown was in power in the first week, and the other people didn't want Chilltown to just run the game. And so right away, we have this structure of two different alliances going at each other, trying to compete for power so that the other alliance doesn't succeed and that their alliance does succeed. This is, of course, the most basic form of alliances. This strategy is that you get as many people on board with you as possible. The more people that are with you, the more likely you are to win an HOH and head a five household and have the power in the game, and the more likely it is that you'll be able to control the vote when the time comes to make a vote. Now, the major problem with this basic structure of alliances is that everything is out in the open. The two sides obviously have incentive to target each other if they get power. If Chilltown wins ahead of household, then it's in their interest to nominate two people from the other people and send one of them home, thus making their numbers advantage even greater, and vice versa, which means that instead of now being protected by being an alliance, you now have a target on your back. You're protected by your allies, sure, but you're now being targeted by your enemies, which really brings us to the second major element of Big Brother strategy that we see in season two, the very beginnings of it. It's a very natural thing that everybody tries to do all the time, not even just in social strategy games, but many people do this all the time. It's a very natural instinct, and the instinct is essentially just have everybody like you. That's what it basically comes down to. In Big Brother, we kind of call this floating. The idea is that you have a relationship with everybody in the house, and you kind of act like you're on their side, even when you're not, because it's impossible to be on everyone's side. But if everyone thinks that you're on their side, then nobody will come after you. Nobody will nominate you. Nobody will vote you out. So the idea of floating came from the concept of if there are two alliances, then a floater will float back and forth between those two alliances each time one of them gains power. So, for example, if Chilltown wins the head of household, then a player would move over to float over to Chilltown and be like, hey, I'm with you guys, loyal to the cause, totally down to take out the other people. Let's go. And then the next week, if one of the other people wins ahead of household, this same person would float back over to the other side and go, hey, the other people, I love you guys. I am definitely on your side, and we should totally take out one of Chilltown because they're the bad guys. So that's the most obvious form of floating, but the concept really applies even more generally than that, because a good floater isn't going to only float between two alliances in a very obvious fashion. A good floater is going to float between every single person in the house. Anytime somebody's HOH, anytime somebody's in power, anytime somebody might be in power, a good floater is somebody who has the ability to maneuver anywhere that they need to at any given point in the game, because they have those relationships and they have the social mobility, the strategic acumen to move in the direction that they need to when they need to. This is something that's very difficult to do without getting caught. And so a lot of people attempt it, and a lot of people fail and get caught and get voted out. Most people in season two attempt some form of floating at one point or another. People in Chilltown trying to make deals with people outside of Chilltown so that they can be cool with them and cool with the rest of the house. Just trying to be cool with everyone. Just trying to get everyone to like you and not want to come after you. It's one of the most basic forms of strategy on the show. A very obvious attempt at this came in week two of Big Brother 2, where Krista won an HOH, and she felt like she was in the middle between both Chilltown and the other people. And so instead of trying to target one side or the other, she tried to take a middle ground stance and target somebody that everyone could agree on in Autumn. She hoped that by doing this, she would avoid being targeted by either side and could continue to maintain her good relationships with everyone in the house. Unfortunately for her, people did see through it, but it still worked for a little while. The other main example of somebody floating in this game, of course, is Dr. Will, who ends up winning the season. He was one of the main people in Chilltown. His entire alliance was voted out because they couldn't win an HOH to save their lives. But once it came down to just Dr. Will, that's when he turned to floating. He started making deals with people in the house. When they would win HOH, he'd make a deal with them. When they weren't HOH, he'd sometimes also make a deal with them. But he tried to pretend that he was secretly on the side of everyone. He was the last of Chilltown. He had nothing left. So now you have to fight amongst yourselves, and you use me for that. I can be your secret weapon. He did very well. He was able to play these people off of each other and snake his way down to the end of the game, and he won the whole thing. The main difference between Dr. Will and Krista is that Dr. Will, even though everyone knew he was a liar, everyone knew he was a snake, all of it, his dealings were a lot more secret. Krista was head of household. She made a very obvious play. It was very obvious to everyone what she was doing. She couldn't hide what she was doing. Every time she made a deal with somebody, it would get out. Dr. Will, even though he would tell people he was lying, he would tell people not to believe him, when he made deals with people, they were secret deals. People weren't able to catch on until it was too late that he was doing what he was doing, which really is the third element, basic element of strategic gameplay that I'm going to be talking about, which is secrecy. Secrecy is a huge element of Big Brother. When I talked about alliances and how two alliances will always just target each other because that's what is in their best interests, that's because everything's out in the open. When I talk about floating and a person trying to float back and forth between two alliances, when that becomes obvious and they get caught, they get sent home. But if they're able to keep it secret, then they might succeed and they might win the game, like Dr. Will did. So the three really basic elements of this sort of alliance structure, what we're talking about here, that emerge in season two: alliance, the basics of floating in the game, being cool with everyone. And then number three, keeping it all secret, keeping it all hidden. And that brings us to season three of the show, the second real season. I'm sorry about the naming, the numbers. It's not my fault. Season three, the second real season of the strategic show. This is where we see the first really successful implementation of a secret alliance. Jason and Danielle, they form a bond really early on. And they understand the importance of keeping that secret. Now, most people knew that they got along. Most people knew that they were probably working together in some capacity. But for the most part, nobody really understood the extent to which they were working together, that they were loyal to one another before anybody else in the house. Two people with a secret bond that nobody knew about. So now they have an alliance, but they're not being targeted for being dangerous, because nobody knows that they're actually an alliance. They're already taking away some of the pitfalls of one of the most basic strategies in the game. Something else that their secret alliance enables them to do is something that I might call alliance floating, where the two of them are able to work together to collectively float or be cool with everyone. The idea behind this is that as a single person, trying to be good with every single person in the house is a Herculean task. People are going to find out if you are everybody's best friend. It's very obvious. But if you have a partner and you divide the work up, then Jason can be close to this half of the cast, and Danielle can be close to this half of the cast, the other half, the other people. And between the two of you, you have everyone covered. Now, there's obviously some danger in that you might not be able to have influence over those people to protect your partner, but you have a lot more influence than you would have as just a single individual. So right away, Jason and Danielle combine all three of those basic elements of strategy. They have an alliance that they make secret, and then collectively they float as an alliance. So not only did they combine them, but they elevated some of these elements to degrees that are much higher than they were to begin with. This is a very, very quick evolution and development of the structure. And right away remains one of the greatest pinnacles of the structure that that we can point to. They really pioneered a lot of the dominant strategy of how you play Big Brother, and they did it so fast. Second season, and they were so successful at it. Unfortunately, neither of them win the game. They trip up at the end. But what they do here is remarkable. So this alliance floating that you might call it, I also like to call it divide and conquer, because it's what you're doing. You're splitting your focus. You're dividing the house up into different groups so that you can have the people in your alliance focus on those groups. So that's what they did. They combined all those three elements. Great stuff from them. They really advanced the strategy of the game, and really not going to be repeated in quite a while. The idea of a secret alliance of, you know, dividing and conquering, this stuff is implemented so well in season three and is not really going to be successfully replicated in a while. There are some difficulties in making this happen. One is that you need somebody that you can trust implicitly, and that's very difficult to get in the Big Brother house. Especially the idea of keeping an alliance secret is difficult, because you just met these people, and in order to bond with them and maintain your bond with them and maintain your trust with them, it's important to spend time with them. But if you're trying to keep your alliance a secret, then it's hard to do that. It's hard to maintain your trust, because you can't hang out with them all the time, because that would make it obvious that you're with them. And so this is a difficult thing to pull off. It's not exactly the best implementation. There's still some evolution. There's still some development to go here to make this a little easier to accomplish and also make it a little more successful, because the other part of this is that with only two people in the alliance, you can split the house up into two and have each person tackle one side of the house. But as I said, one person, just Jason trying to influence half the house to not go after Danielle, that's kind of a difficult task. The more people you have, the smaller the groups that you can split people up into, and the more influence you'll have over those groups to protect each other. Getting more people involved is kind of the next big step, because with more people, you can actually spend more time together, individually or as a group or whatever. It's easier to keep those people together. And also, it allows you to have more influence, more control, and it's overall just going to be more successful for you. So that's kind of the next step here, to introduce more people into the alliance to make that a more successful secret floating alliance. So what we see in season four, following season three, is that there was kind of an attempt at a big secret alliance. The Elite Eight is formed. They're the first eight into the house, before some exes join them, and they all make a pact that they're going to stick together and take out all the exes. And importantly, they decide to try to keep that a secret. Now, the problem is eight was too many people. They could not keep this a secret for very long. It only took a couple of weeks for some of them to get a little upset with the status quo, decided they liked some of the other people a little bit better, and they outed the whole thing and betrayed the alliance. And just like that, the attempt fails. Now, June also implements some other great strategies. She has kind of a secret alliance with G, which is a little bit less of a floating alliance than it is just a secret partnership that she uses to help her float as an individual. And then she's also going to make some late game alliances, and those are going to help her out. So she's really a very fluid player, of a floater that is also capable of making some secret deals, some late game breaking deals, and eventually gets to the end and wins. A very individual player. This isn't an alliance win. This is a win by an individual, similar to Dr. Will, who kind of scraped and scratched and managed to make her way to the end. So then in season five, we see the Four Horsemen is an alliance that is attempted with four guys who get together. Doesn't work. Four people was too many, I guess, and they pretty quickly implode. It just doesn't work. There's another crew as well, that's sort of an opposing alliance to the Four Horsemen, and they also implode and start attacking each other. And what results is another sort of mess of a game where it's a lot of individuals just scraping by, no real structure to the game apart from just the attempts to maneuver and adapt to what is presented in front of them. And there's plenty to be said about that style of game as well. I'm just focusing on structure here, alliance structure. That is the focus of this particular podcast. But I will, if people like this one, then I will definitely go back and focus a little more on like individual floating, on you know, sort of emergent alliance creation and how that works and the development of that throughout the game. But for right now, I'm only mostly talking about structure and the best structure of alliances as it develops throughout the game. So right now we still have season 3, Jason and Danielle. They are the gold standard for an alliance structure that really dominates and is very effective in a lot of different ways, that combines a lot of different elements and really elevates those elements beyond what the basics could even imagine. But up until this point, we haven't really had a successful big alliance. And all of the attempted big alliances, whether they're secret or not, they've all crumbled. They've all turned on each other. They've all really just crashed and burned. No one alliance has really been able to stick together and maintain any kind of structure toward the end game before they just completely fall apart. But that's going to change in season 6. In season 6, two alliances form, pretty typical of the strategy at the time. Two alliances going at it, nothing secret. It's just a matter of like who wins the competitions, how do things break up, and what new alliances form. But something changes in Big Brother 6 in that new alliances don't form when the two alliances start to get broken up. Things don't shift as much. And that's because there is one alliance in particular that is really going to maintain its structure. And that's the Friendship Alliance. So the Friendship Alliance consisted of a group of people led by Eric. They called him Cappy. And the twist of the season was that each player had a partner that they knew from real life. And his partner was Maggie. So Eric and Maggie were pretty much the heads of the alliance that emerged here that was opposed to the Sovereign Six, which was a group of people who felt like they did not fit in with that group of people, with Cappy and his crew. And so the two alliances really go at it head to head, and they're trading HOHs back and forth, each side losing a member here and there. But in particular, the Friendship Alliance fairly quickly loses their leader, Eric Cappy, who at least people perceived to be the leader of that group. And when Cappy leaves, Maggie really takes the reins of this alliance and turns Cappy into, a fallen soldier. He has been deified. He has been, turned into they worship at the idol of fallen Cappy. And she really uses it to bond their group together. And she structures the alliance. And that's the important thing. She takes this group of people and she knows how to keep them together and keep her at the center of everything. Now, this is where I'm going to borrow a term from Survivor. On Survivor, this is eventually referred to as an onion alliance. Now, in Survivor, an onion alliance is even more relevant because on Survivor, everybody votes. All you need is a majority of the votes to maintain your power in the game for the most part. So, in Survivor, if you have a tribe of 8 people, how an onion alliance would work is that you take 5 of those 8, a majority, and you say, us 5, we are an alliance. Then within those 5, you take 3 of those 5, a majority of the 5, and you say, we are the core of this five-person alliance. We are the true alliance. The other two, they're just the outer layer of the onion. They're helping us with the numbers for now, but eventually they will be the ones to go when all the other three people leave. So when it comes down to five, we'll still maintain our majority. Then you take two of the three and you say, these are the real two. These two, the majority of three, we are the true core power of the onion structure. And so if you are the pair in control of the overall group, then you are running the show. And this helps not only, you know, keep you in power, even as the alliance takes out of all of your enemies, but it also can help you structure your alliance and help you keep your alliance together, because that might be what the onion actually looks like, but you can pretend that the onion looks like something else. So you can take those two people who are on the outs and go to them and say, we are actually the core three. The other two are the ones that are going to leave, and keep them thinking that they are in the good position, that they are not on the outer layer of the onion. And then when the time comes, you let them go. Now, Maggie didn't have a super locked in structure like that, but she operated her alliance in the same vein, with using the same philosophy, that she was at the core of everything, and she tried to make everyone feel like they were in the core with her. Because of that, it allowed her to peel off layers of her alliance piece by piece. As the other alliance won in HOH, she was able to sacrifice the least valuable member of her alliance to move forward and maintain her structure. And then as her alliance started to win over and over and take out the other side, it put her in a position of power where she was able to again control the outcome as the people went down, and she was always able to maintain her safety and then eventually win the game via her onion alliance. Now we are going to take a quick break for our sponsors and we'll be right back. And we're back. So let's get back to the show. So now we have that sort of fourth piece introduced to the strategy of crafting this ultimate alliance structure, right? You have what Danielle and Jason managed to do, the secret floating alliance, but you just needed to add more people. How do you do that successfully? Well, now we have an idea. Maggie has introduced us to the idea of this onion structure. If you can introduce an onion structure to a secret alliance, perhaps we'll find some success. So we head into season 7, the All-Star season, and we definitely see some attempts here. So Danielle is back to iterate on her secret alliance concept. We have Dr. Will back, who is, of course, going to take floating to another level as well. And we are really going to see a lot of different attempts at really developing these strategies. So in particular, we see Danielle and Dr. Will, along with James and Mike Boogie, two of their allies, they are going to come together and make a four-person secret alliance. Danielle's, she sees what she needs to do, right? She is iterating. She is developing this structure. She is bringing in two more people. It's now a four-person secret alliance. They call it the Legion of Doom. Now, the Legion of Doom, for those that know Big Brother, we're going to talk about a later alliance called the Brigade. The Legion of Doom is kind of a prototype for the Brigade. It's a four-person secret alliance where they are dividing and conquering. They're floating as a group. They have connections to various people. You know, Dr. Will is working on Janelle. Mike Boogie and Danielle are both working on people like Erica. Danielle's working on Marcellus. James is working on, you know, Howie and the rest of the Sovereign Six people from season 6. And so with all four of them working different areas of the house, they have some real power in the game. And you can see the seeds here for something that can be very, very successful. So for around 3 weeks or so, they are successful. They have some serious success here. They are able to do very well in the game as a group. The problem here is, once again, they don't really have this onion structure. They don't really have any kind of structure in the group. It's two pairs coming together. And because of that, neither pair can feel particularly comfortable. Again, the key to keeping an alliance of any size greater than two together is keeping them comfortable. And you keep them comfortable by making them feel like they have an advantage. So that's why the onion structure is so effective, is because you're able to pretend that everyone has an advantage. Everyone thinks that they're in the majority, and so nobody feels like they need to escape from it. But when there's two obvious pairs working together, then both of those pairs are going to be looking for edges that they can have over the other pair when the time comes, especially when you're talking about four very good, very self-interested players. This alliance, unfortunately, was doomed from the start. So after a few weeks of working together, eventually they turn on each other, and that's the end of the Legion of Doom. A solid attempt, though. And Dr. Will doesn't stop there. He continues with the alliance floating, the dividing, the conquering. He just works on it with Chilltown. So he had Chilltown, himself, and Mike Boogie. They were essentially the Danielle and Jason. Obviously, they were obvious as a pair. They couldn't keep it a secret, but they were able to float as a group, as an alliance. They were able to divide and conquer at least a little bit. And through that, they were able to do very, very well in this game. They temporarily expanded it to the Legion of Doom and then closed it off again when they cut off Danielle and James, and then ran the rest of the way toward the end, continuing with the strategy of floating as an alliance. So at this point, we've seen a few different combinations of these elements coming together, but nothing has really clicked all the way yet. We've seen now consistently that a secret alliance is very effective, that a floating alliance is very effective, that a secret floating alliance is incredibly effective, but we haven't been able to grow that power yet. We've seen that an onion alliance can be very effective. So we just need to put them all together. Somebody needs to do it. So we move on to season 8. And this is a tricky one because Eric Stein is really the runner of the show here. And his game was controlled by America. This is an unfortunate situation in terms of talking about the development of strategy in Big Brother, because Eric was really doing some interesting things in the game before he really has to change what he's doing because America said so. So Eric is definitely able to put together an onion alliance. It's mostly a secret. He's really working a few different angles with this secret enough onion alliance that he puts together, weakening different factions of the alliance to keep them reliant on the whole that he is at the center of. Unfortunately for him, because of his status as America's player, he gets outed by a banner plane while they're having a competition. He gets targeted, but his structure is actually so strong that he's able to survive being targeted by his own by two of his own previous allies, and maintain the structure moving forward. It's less of a secret at that point, but it's still a structure, and he's able to move forward with that. Unfortunately, once again for him, as he tries to move forward with his just more basic onion structure, he's then forced to betray those people and side with the people who targeted him, because that's what America told him to do. I don't know, this is confusing for those that haven't seen the season, but basically he had a secret onion alliance kind of ready to go. He was almost there. He'd almost put those things together in a way that in the way that we've been talking about, but because of the Twist's interference and America's interference, his structure was outed a bit, and it wasn't secret anymore. And then he had to turn on those people and abandon that structure. And so he was forced into a situation where he was just playing the floater role, the alliance floater role, because he had a partner in Jessica. And so this is really the brilliance of Eric's game, is that he starts with the pinnacle, the thing we're looking for in terms of the best alliance structure you can make. And then as his game is attacked by America and the twist, he is able to pivot into the next best, the next strongest thing, as he goes. So he falls all the way down to the essentially what Chilltown did, the pair that is floating as a pair, him and Jessica sort of bouncing back and forth, trying to be cool with everyone. And he's successful at that. That was his worst case scenario. That was his sort of last resort, was the strategy that really won Chilltown the game in the previous season. And he does it very well as well. Again, unfortunately for him, his hands are so tied throughout so much of the game that eventually him and his ally, they are going to take a fall. But we see some very interesting things here. Unfortunately, does not really contribute to the overall development of the strategy, because each time Eric tries to do something, it's often just cut short until he's forced into something that has already been done. So then we move on to season 9, and then we move on to season 10, because season 9 was season 9. Just to help you out, some things happen in season 9. I would not say that they contributed or were really built upon anything in the past. It was season 9. All right. So season 10 happens. In season 10, right off the bat, we see Brian and Dan attempt to do what we're talking about. They are trying to build. Now, these are two guys who Brian doesn't know the game very well, but he's a smart guy. Dan does know the game very well, very naturally gifted at the game, and they come together and they plan on creating exactly what we're talking about. They just instinctually understand, based on the knowledge they've gained watching the show, knowing social strategy, whatever, that they want to create this. They want to create a secret Onion Alliance with plans to divide and conquer, to float, that this is going to dominate the game. This is it, ready to go. And right away, it crumbles. They had the right idea. They really did. But they chose the wrong people. In particular, they chose Ollie, who is going to get into a relationship with April and eventually out what Brian and Dan are trying to do. And so right away, it crumbles. It fails. Brian gets sent home immediately. And now Dan is sitting there like, oh boy, well, that didn't work out. Time for plan B of, you know, a million plans. So Dan pivots because he couldn't even get any kind of structure going at all before it all crumbled. So Dan is forced to pivot into just floating for a little while, rehabilitating his image, you know, pitting two groups against each other until he's able to start to build again. And he does that by making a secret alliance with Memphis that he calls the Renegades. And then through that, he's able to build a little bit bigger. He's able to pull in people like Keisha and Rennie. So Dan is able to create kind of an onion structure within this group of people by having this extra secret alliance with Memphis. And so within the group of four that he has, he's dividing and conquering. And so it's like you can see what he would have done if he had been given a big group at the start that hadn't broken up, that he knew exactly what to do. He just does it on a smaller scale in the second half of the game once he's finally able to build again. And so that's what we see from Dan here in season 10. Again, we see this so close. An attempt, we see a little mini version of it. This is probably the closest we've seen yet to you know, this real what we're looking for, this ideal structure. Then we get to season 11, where Jesse from season 10 comes back and plays again, plays with a bunch of new players, and he now has a better understanding of how these games work. He structures an alliance. It's a pretty obvious alliance. It's not a secret alliance by any means, but he structures an alliance with sort of an onion structure. He's really got a dominant game going until a twist comes in and swipes him away. And from that point forward, it's a little more, you know, scraping by kind of deal, which finally brings us to season 12, where the Brigade comes in and is finally able to implement what we've been trying to work toward basically ever since season three, ever since season six, when the onion structure really came into prominence. We're finally able to see all of these elements come together, that four people instead of just two are able to come together at the start of the season. If they choose the right people, they come together, four person secret alliance that divides and conquers. They float around, that is structured as an onion, with Matt unfortunately being the person on, left on the outs, they're pretending that he's not. And so the Brigade is the first real successful larger secret alliance that floats with an onion structure that is implemented, and it completely dominates the season. Nothing before it had ever been done this successfully. We've been theorizing that that this is the ideal way, that if we combine these elements, it will really work. But the Brigade really, really showed just how dominant a structure this is if implemented correctly. How this worked is that the four of them came together. Each one of them had at least one other person that they were working on. So Matt was working on Reagan. Hayden worked on Kristen. Lane worked on Brittany, and so on and so forth. They weren't just working on one person, though. In general, they were splitting the house up into different groups. Each one of them were working their relationships with a different group of people, so that every one of the four of them had a large amount of influence on a small group of people to protect the others in the event that anybody won in HOH. That they would use that influence to keep each other safe, and then they would also use their influence to control the eviction order in a way that benefited them, to keep all of their most loyal and easiest to control people in the game for as long as possible, so that they were able to run down to the end in very successful fashion. And of course, the secret ingredient to this, the Onion Alliance structure, which is what keeps them together, which is the key component of making this work, was that, of course, Hayden, Lane, and Enzo really worked on keeping Matt comfortable, even though they all knew that he was the one that they would send out first, and they did end up sending him out pretty early, so that they could run to the end together. And of course, at that point as well, they were still working, with just three people. They were able to break off into pairs and kind of think that, oh, well, we're the real pair, so on and so forth. So it kept them together, which kept them working the house, which was very successful. They completely dominate. And this is now the pinnacle of Big Brother Alliance structure. At this point, it's reached a point where it's almost too much. It makes the season a little bit boring how good it is. It's so successful that there were many fans that were like, this sucks. There's no contest anymore. They're too good at this. So to speak on the Brigade and its structure, I got its architect, Matt Hoffman, on the phone to talk about it.
Yeah, I was always a huge fan of the Danielle Jason Secret Alliance, how well it worked and how well they, everyone's a stranger. So I love that these people who were strangers had this kind of like really quick trust. We're like, yeah, I'm going to believe you. Let's just part ways and do our thing and trust that we believe each other. And I thought that was awesome. And you're totally right. The Brigade was just sort of a quadrupling of that.
Yeah.
But it's hard. I mean, the blind faith, Big Brother is not the arena for blind faith, but that's what you need to have happen for it to work. And my particular trajectory through the Brigade, that blind faith kind of bit me in the ass because I was sort of hanging with my side alliance too much and they didn't believe that I was with them. I was just doing the side alliance thing. So that, yeah, you need to have that just that blind loyalty to make that kind of stuff work.
Yeah. And I think that something that I sort of noticed over, different groups trying to make something like this work is that, you know, there's in Survivor, they call it an onion, structure, right? Where, in a group of like five, you know, you have an alliance of five, but really, there's a group of three within the five, and really within the three, there's a group, there's two, right? And that's like the, you know, you peel off the layers of the onion as you go. And in order to sort of keep that structure together, the three convinces the two on the outside that they're in the three, when they're really not. And then the two convinces the one that they're, you know, so on and so forth. And in a way, I kind of feel like Hayden was pretty successful in convincing many of the members of the brigade that like they were with him. I don't recall exactly how good you felt with Hayden, but I definitely remember that both Enzo and Lane felt pretty good about Hayden in terms of like, I'm the guy that Hayden's with. I think that was pretty key in sort of keeping the structure intact.
I never thought I was the guy Hayden was with, but I never thought I was the guy Hayden was against either. So I really, that's all that matters. So he did a great job of doing that.
Can you tell me about like when you started the alliance, when you first got into the house, like what was it like building it? What was the plan, and how did you think that you were going to make it work?
Well, another aspect that I enjoy about Big Brother, and just forget about Big Brother, I guess games or just life in general, is a manipulation of the system without cheating. It's just you're taking the what exists and going, how can I look at it a different way? And Nokomis did that with, you know, what became the back door. There wasn't a twist that allowed that to happen. She just took what was there and said, hey, we can do it this way and make it work this way for our advantage. And that's sort of how I feel the brigade went down. It was fun because we weren't taking advantage of any kind of twists or benefit in the game. We just looked at the numbers of the game and, you know, you see how that all falls together and you go, well, if we do this and we have these side alliances, now we have all the numbers and we have coverage. So it just kind of worked, and it was, again, it wasn't part of a twist or, you know, any season could have done this prior. It's just how you perceive the people in the house as pawns in this game that they are.
Yeah. I kind of referred to it in this podcast, at least, and some people might take umbrage with it, but I kind of look at it just as like alliance floating, like you're floating in the game as an alliance, like floating, meaning that like the concept of floating is that somebody drifts floats from alliance to alliance, from person to person, pretending to be loyal to whoever they need to in order to stay good in the game. And I think that what Danielle and Jason did initially was they floated as an alliance together. Collectively, they pooled together their resources of these are my connections. These are my connections, and then made it a lot easier to kind of play that floater game. And so then when there are four people, obviously it's much more successful. Did you have any idea of how much success you would have in this? Or did you feel like, well, we're going to try, but...
Initially, the trepidation was all just, hey, I'm playing Big Brother and you need to just blanket trust these guys. But it was clear pretty quickly that when the strategy gets laid out and it makes sense and it benefits us all, we just kind of really believed each other. The one thing I would take maybe a little bit of disagreement with the whole alliance floating thing is that's a little bit more... a little bit more subtle, I think, because a key component, at least to the brigade strategy in regards to the side alliances, was making sure that those side alliances were very, very apparent. And although it didn't come to fruition outside of the Hayden Kristen nomination, what happened at that nomination, theoretically, in the interest of game theory, was exactly the purpose of a side alliance. Because you go, oh, we want Hayden out. Well, who should we get out with him? His very, very overt alliance member that they think is Kristen. You want to be up on the block against this other person so that you know you avoid being on the block against one of these core members. So that's important to have been kind of, you know, out in the open about the bullshit part of it.
Yeah, well, I think that the sort of like, for me, like the floating aspect is that if Hayden is good with Kristen, then all of you are good with Kristen, right?
Yes.
And the secret part of it is that all of you are together and that she's actually just this sort of shield. Like, yes. You know, as I go through Big Brother 4 and I'm looking at what June is doing, like how floating benefits her is that anytime that she flips over to a new side, that side has bigger targets in front of her. Even if she's obviously floating, obviously with that side, there are people that are going to go in front of her. And I think, again, you sort of co-opt that element through this by having a side alliance with another person. They don't even need to be a bigger target because you also have all of those other hidden numbers behind you that nobody else can even see.
You're right. And there's an ease. It sets the mind at ease of the people in the side alliances because they really are protected. I mean, their end game is done before it ever started, but the intention is to bring them along. You know, we want them there as long as you can have them there. So they are playing a protected game and they will see that protection. And that kind of adds to the ruse, I believe.
So how intentional was it when you like chose you knew you all wanted at least one person? Did you try to plot it out or did you just kind of let it naturally evolve?
No, I remember that night talking about it and saying the point of this is to make it like real. So just find whoever you want to chill with them. And Lane was already a little bit on Brittany, and Reagan and I weren't. That could have gone in any direction for me, like potentially with other people, I think. And then Hayden and Kristen probably also, that was one that kind of evolved that. I think Lane and Brittany were like the only ones that were already sort of set.
Yeah. Did you ever go like Enzo? Like, come on.
We did a lot of time. It became kind of like a running joke, but yeah. I think he tagged Brendan somewhere along the line there. At the end.
Yeah. Yeah, they really worked Brendan after you left. So do you think that, you know, you were a fan of the game? Did you feel like you were sort of taking the knowledge that you had from what came before and implementing something that I've talked about is that, you know, if you look at season 7, like the Legion of Doom is a 4-person secret alliance where they do have other people outside of it that they're trying to work. And it's a pretty successful alliance for like 3 weeks before they turn on each other. But it sort of seems like a prototype for the Brigade almost.
Yeah, the only thing that was on my mind, consciously at least, was the secret alliance of Jason and Danielle. And I, unless this was not clear, I did not come into the house pre-game going, hey, I'm going to do this, you know, the Brigade structure. But I definitely wanted a secret alliance, and I was thinking to do a couple, maybe, you know, like put pair two secret alliances together. And it wasn't until we were all up in that room that night, the four of us, that it all just kind of came out and clicked and started bringing up the secret alliances and how we could all do this. And it all just started ping-ponging ideas. And that's where it came to be. It was pretty organic with like a little bit of a backdrop of the Jason guy, Danielle Reyes thing.
If you had one piece of advice, like if you want to replicate something like this, how do you make it work?
You really need trust. That is critical, I think, to any alliance. Well, even if you're not going to replicate the Brigade structure, any alliance you want to look at that's been successful, I believe it's rooted in trust.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, man. This is fun.
So we head to season 13, where we kind of move backwards a little bit. We're certainly not going to see anything at the level of the Brigade there. We see a few different attempts at secret alliances, just alliances moving back and forth. We see some floating and stuff like that. Some at this point, basic level Big Brother play before we head into season 14. Season 14 is another weird one because you've got Dan Giesling again. You've got Mike Boogie again, two people that understand the value of, you know, pairs of secret alliances, of floating as an alliance. But these people have massive targets on their back, and they also come in as coaches and aren't really playing until a few weeks in. And so the waters get a little muddied. But what we eventually come to is that Dan is still, despite the target on his back, able to, for the most part here, create once again a secret large onion floating alliance called the Quack Pack. He initially had one with Mike called the Silent Six, But Dan was always a little bit better about the onion structure than Mike Boogie was. And so Mike is going to end up getting kicked out of that alliance pretty quickly. And it turns into the Quack Pack, which includes Ian instead. And so the Quack Pack is the largest secret alliance with a floating structure that we really have to this point. It's a little bit larger than the Brigade, but it came into... It was created a little bit later in the game because of all this weird stuff. And it also was not exactly as secret or as effective an alliance. Again, there were a lot of different complicating factors with the returning players and all that. But once again, the basics of what I'm trying to say here is that we see that Dan, again, is going to try to create this overall structure that does eventually allow him to just completely plow his way to the end with the experience that he has with these onion structures and these secret deals and floating and all of that. He is really able to just completely dominate his way toward the end of the game, where he then loses. But that's another story. We head into season 15, where we do see a big group of people come together. They are kind of a secret group. At this point in Big Brother meta strategy, alliances are secret. At this point, alliances have just become secrets. That kind of starts with Big Brother 12 more than anything. Certainly, we saw attempts in Big Brother 7, we saw attempts in Big Brother 8 and 10, then really, really successful implementation in 12. And then after 12, for the most part, nobody's making an alliance without trying to make it secret with various levels of success. But we're seeing a lot more success from this point forward in terms of just this is an alliance, but it's a secret. And so we've now reached the point where the basic level of the game is you don't make an alliance unless you're also making it secret. And so in season 15, we have some attempts at secret alliances. We have some big alliances. The moving company tries to replicate what the Brigade did, but unsuccessfully. Again, bad choice in members, as we see McCray is going to get cozy with Amanda and then out the alliance to the rest of the house. And then we're really going to see Andy take floating to a whole new level once again. Many people call it rat floating, but that's another podcast. So then we get to Big Brother 16, and this is truly where it all comes together. Derek Levasseur comes into the game. He knows the show. He knows the game. He is naturally gifted at these things, and he is able to create the pinnacle of what we're looking at here, the ultimate development of where we've reached in alliance structure dominance. And that is the Bomb Squad, which is a secret, large onion alliance that divides and conquers. It floats around the house. It's got everything and it's perfectly structured. You have the Bomb Squad that consists of around 8 people. Within the Bomb Squad, you have the Detonators, which consists of around 5 people. Within the Detonators, you have the Hitmen, Derek and Cody, who are a secret alliance within the Detonators, who divide and conquer within the Detonators to create that onion structure. So Cody is working on people like Christine. Derek is working on people like Caleb and Frankie. And just in general, they are focusing on keeping everyone happy, keeping the onion structure of the Detonators and the Bomb Squad and everything nice and tight so that they are in full control of what's happening. And that's exactly what they do. With this structure, the Bomb Squad, the Detonators, the Hitmen, they are able to reach out. They are dividing and conquering throughout the entire house. They're doing exactly what the Brigade did, just on a larger scale, which allows them to have even more success and even more control. And it's implemented flawlessly. Now, we just finished Big Brother 21 at the time of this recording, and still to this day, Big Brother 16, the Bomb Squad, remains the pinnacle of alliance structure in Big Brother. There have been many attempts to replicate it since then. Most of them fail. Most of them fail because they don't understand the structure that made it work. So I felt like this podcast would not be entirely complete without just at least a little bit of input from the man who was able to accomplish this feat, the guy himself, Derek Levasseur. And so so I called him up to get some of his take on this structure and how he did it and how he feels about it. But what you did in season 16 was you had sort of the bomb squad, which was like an eight person group. I felt like part of what made that effective was you had that sort of like onion structure where you had the majority within the group and then a majority within that majority. And then, you know, so on and so forth. And you had everyone convinced that they were in the good part of the group, to help structure it all. So you had this massive secret sort of floating, divide and conquer alliance that was structured like an onion. And it really feels like the pinnacle of what you can do in the game. And it's kind of like other people have tried to attempt to recreate this, with varying levels of success. And so I just wanted to like quickly get your thoughts on like what you did to create the alliance, how much thought you had put into the structure before heading in, and how, why you think it was so effective and the implementation worked so well.
Yeah, you know, it's essentially what you just said. And it's funny because I remember specifically there was a point when I was playing the game where the DR called me in and said, you know, what would you describe what you're doing? And at the time I said a Wi-Fi signal, right? Like you have the biggest line at the top. And then as it, you know, gets closer to the middle, it's just a dot. You know what I mean? Like it's like that cone. And but I think an onion analogy is probably even better. But, you know, it's, it was kind of an evolution of what was handed to me, right? Like I didn't go in there with that strategy. I went in there with the idea that I was going to find one person that I felt I could trust. And I was going to basically risk my game on that instinct, on that gut instinct that that person would be my, you know, quote unquote ride or die. And the person that I could bounce information off of and compare notes and not worry about being backstabbed. So that person on day two was Cody. So I knew I had my core, right? And then I was planning on bringing some other people in and I had some ideas. It actually wasn't Caleb or anybody like that because they, Caleb and Devin had already kind of established like the bromance and like they were the kings of the house, right? Like, so we, I was on the outside, me and Cody were on the outside. And so I was looking more for people like, to be honest, like Nicole or Donnie. But then within that first 2 weeks, I got approached about the bomb squad. And what was interesting, and I don't know if it was edited this way, I don't even remember, but they had brought me in earlier in the day and asked me to be in the bomb squad. And they were thinking maybe like, you know, four or five people. And then I had suggested to them to bring in Cody. And the reason why I suggested that is I wanted to use the bomb squad as a big blanket to cover our little alliance, right? Because if we were both the Trojan horse in that alliance, it would be easier for us to hide it because if he wasn't in the bomb squad and they saw me communicating with him, it would raise red flags, right? But by having him in the same alliance with me, I could communicate with him and talk about him to them and it wouldn't cause anyone to take a second guess because they would think, well, Cody and Derek are both in this. So I had, you know, broached the idea of bringing Cody in and they were all about it. So they brought him in on their own. I made sure, you know, I wasn't part of that conversation. So it didn't look like we were collaborating together, Cody and I. And sure enough, they brought us in. So Cody and I said, okay, we have this big umbrella covering us now, eight people. It's too many. It's too many people. It's not going to work. So we need a more core alliance. And as the game evolved over the next couple of weeks, I said, we need a more stronger group, a smaller group that we can roll with going forward that necessarily wouldn't be, again, they wouldn't raise any flags if they knew that I was bringing Cody into it. Again, because if you notice, the pattern's going to be every alliance that I made, there was always one constant, and that was Cody. Nobody ever picked up on that. But the constant was through each alliance that I developed, the one consistent was Cody. So in that next alliance, which was Detonators, I said, you know, let's go with a smaller group that we feel we can trust. And at the time, I wasn't very close with Caleb. Again, I felt like he was kind of, you know, on the Amber train and on the Devin train. And he didn't really warm up to me at first. So I didn't trust him. And so I decided to go with the others, Frankie, Zach, Christine, myself, and Cody. And as the game progressed, what happened was, and it wasn't expected, we came to kind of like an even smaller group, which was me, Caleb, and Cody. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really have an alliance for that one, but it just, when Amber went home, I knew Caleb was more into the game, and he kind of changed his perspective while he was in there. When he shaved his hair and stuff, he kind of became more vulnerable. So created a smaller alliance. And again, knowing that as the game progressed, more people were going to become expendable with less people available for eviction. And that's what we did. We slowly just kind of whittled it away, but always keeping in mind that the at the core of whatever alliance we were in was going to be Cody and I. And the one difficult part about that is convincing everyone, like you said earlier, that they're part of the real alliance, mm-hmm. that they are in the, they're in the inn, right? Like, although there's this bigger alliance, they know the truth is that they're in the real alliance. And there's some risk to that. I can't say it's all skill. There's some risk to it. It's about communicating and reassuring them, and also making sure that because of paranoia, certain individuals don't see other individuals together more often than they should be. For example, you know, if I'm saying we're detonator strong, there's four or five of us, and yet I don't say two words to them after we establish the alliance, but they see me with Cody every single day, just by assumption, they're going to assume that there's something more with me and Cody. And we were very good about not doing that, but yeah, that, I don't know where you want to go with it, but that was the kind of the, it was an adaptation of what was kind of presented to me. And then once I got it rolling, I figured this is the pattern I want to go with. As we get further in the game, I want to decrease the size of the next alliance I make, always keeping in mind that at the core of every alliance, if nobody picks up on it, is going to be the two common figures, which is me and Cody.
Yeah. And it's almost like, sort of like how Danielle and Jason way back in the day, they were a secret pair together. They worked the entire house as a pair. You and Cody maintained your position in each alliance you were in by maintaining the secrecy of the two of you together. And, you know, he would have his social connections that felt mm-hmm. like they were the closest to him, and you'd have your social connections. And then through that sort of like divide and conquer strategy, you managed to sort of play that game within the alliance that you were in, which was very effective as well, I think.
Yeah. And you just, and you said it too, you know, there were certain people, Cody had, he was talking in the beginning, he was really close with Nicole, and mm-hmm. Donnie trusted him, mm-hmm. You know, blindly. Donnie would tell him everything. So I didn't need to be close with Donnie because I knew Cody was, and vice versa. I was very close with Victoria. Cody wasn't. So there were people outside of that core, outside of those individual alliances, the people who needed to have that reassurance. Like Donnie never, you know, he wanted to be in an alliance, but he just, again, kind of blindly trusted Cody. And Victoria, same thing. You know, she viewed me as a friend, which I was. We were friends and we are friends, but she didn't need anything in writing, like an alliance name or something. So I could just work that side of the house. He could work his side of the house, and everyone within the alliance that knew of the alliance felt like we were all trying to benefit each other to get further, which was partially true. But, you know, as we got further, we realized there were certain people that were expendable or were a risk to our games because they were unpredictable. And we slowly found ways to convince the larger alliances that we needed to decrease size and to not worry, right? Because if we got rid of one of the detonator members, that doesn't mean that detonators are over. It just means we cut the fat, right? Mm-hmm. You're still part of Team Detonators. You're still in the core group, like you said earlier. And before they realized that they weren't, we tried to set it up in a way where there was nothing they could do about it. You know, there was not anyone around that they could kind of, you know, rally up and create a resistance against it. The numbers weren't in their favor at that point, and unless they won a competition, they kind of, their fate was kind of sealed.
Yeah. And so it really feels like the optimal structure for, you know, for any alliance. And it does feel like a lot of people since season 16 have attempted to recreate this. They might not like fully understand the structure. They might not like exactly be trying to copy it, but I think a lot of these concepts are being attempted in seasons since yours. I think Paul in season 19 probably comes the closest to actually being able to replicate it, but other than that, it feels like a lot of them are failing when they're trying to recreate this. A lot of big, like a big secret alliance forms almost every season now at the start of the season, but they always crumble and they always completely just disintegrate instead of slowly peeling away like what happened with you. Do you have an idea of as to why that is?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple, actually. Paul's a great example, right? So I kind of look at my season as like a Venn diagram. Like all the circles, if they're all different alliances, they all had some level of overlap, right? So like even though Bomb Squad had different people than, you know, Detonators, I also had an alliance with Nicole and Hayden called, you know, what was it called?
I can't remember either.
Oh, it was such a stupid name too. But it was me, Hayden, Cody, and Nicole. Mm-hmm. And so that alliance overlapped. So again, there was never any red flags raised when I would talk to certain groups, because there were groups within the groups, and people always felt like when they saw me working, it was for the benefit of that particular alliance that I was in with them. Mm-hmm. With Paul, it was very black and white, right? There was one side of the house and there was another side of the house, and Paul was in the middle playing both sides, and he did it very effectively for a long time. The downfall with that strategy is, instead of them being okay with the fact that you're just downsizing because of attrition, because people are going home, they go back when they get to jury and they realize that although you were telling them one thing, you were with the other side. Mm-hmm. And it creates this animosity, which can lead to someone voting against you. And so he did a very good job at kind of balancing both sides. But if you remember, he'd be in the room with Josh, and then he'd be in the room with Whistlenut or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, the other, you know, like he was trying to play both sides. And that can only work so long before they say he's supposed to be with us, but we have a defined group of individuals that are the quote unquote enemy. And we keep seeing him with them as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too, because a lot of like, you know, I think you used a lot of like structuring, like the onion structure, the yeah. sort of like you're in, as you said, like the Venn diagram in order to keep your group together. Whereas Paul did use sort of the vilification of the other side to keep his group together. That was yeah. sort of his way of doing it, which did end up costing him a bit. And I think also he didn't have like a ride or die partner. I'm seeing certainly Josh was like fully with him, but wasn't as much of an equal partner right. as Cody as well. Was.
And Christine as well. No, that and that's really it, because when you're vilifying the other side, it's contradictory to vilify them to your one team and then go hang out with them all day. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't add up for anyone who has a lot of time in the house to kind of think about things where you're like, listen, they're the enemy. We don't want to associate with them. You know, Paul was trying to keep them away from each other so they didn't compare notes. And by doing that, he would come back and say, oh, I'm just trying to get information. But after a while, people will start to say, well, are you getting information or are you getting votes? You know, what are you really doing? So it does raise flags where with me, I had multiple alliances that were layered on top of each other. So depending on who I was speaking with, I could always go back if someone saw me with that person and kind of cover myself and say, hey, that person's they're with us as well, but they're not in it like you and I. They're in the alliance, but they're in the big alliance. You're in the small alliance. They're just necessary right now. So there was no two defined sides. There was more of a vertical system where mm-hmm. you were either at the top of the totem pole or the bottom. And I always tried to make people feel like although they saw me talking to others within those alliances, they were at the top of that totem pole, when in reality, the only person who really was Cody.
Yeah. So if there's one piece of advice that you'd give for somebody who wants to create this structure, and if they're going to play the game, what do you think is the biggest key ingredient?
The biggest key ingredient, in my opinion, is trying to be as truthful as possible. And there's ways to be truthful while also being deceptive, because you're going to get called out. You're going to get called out at some point, either in a nice way or a bad way. So I'll give one quick example. Okay. When I was trying to make a bigger alliance and trying to shrink it down to a smaller size. I wouldn't say, for example, Frankie's got to go. He's toxic. You know, he's bad for our game. He's doesn't deserve the money, because then if I was seen with him near the end of the day and hanging out, it looked like I was trying to set him up, but also trying to get a vote. And that doesn't fly well with people because they want to be on equal playing terms. So what I would do is I would get in a group and say, wow, Frankie's playing a great game. Frankie's one of the best players here. He's going to win every comp down the stretch. And then I knew, although my motives weren't pure, what I was saying was actually a compliment. So the worst thing that could happen would be Frank coming to me and saying, hey, are you talking good about me? are you complimenting me? Are you giving, because it was there was nothing to cross reference where they could say, for example, and this didn't actually happen, but Frank and Christine could get together and go, hey, Christine, Derek was talking shit about you. He was saying bad things about your game. And she could go, well, he was saying bad things about you too. So I think that's what happened with Paul when we talk about the vilifying. So it's try to be as truthful as you can, but present it in a way that ultimately benefits you, so that if they do compare notes, which even on my season they did, the worst that they could say is you're very complimentary of everyone within the group, and you always preach teamwork, and you always preach, you know, unity and being together and cohesiveness. And although that you are preaching that, what you're really doing is keeping them together so that there's never any dissension within the group. And because there's no dissension within the group, there's really no cross-examination of what I'm saying, which allows me to use the excuse as we get smaller that, hey, I really like this person, but obviously by numbers, someone has to go. This isn't anything personal. And in reality, I just always had to make sure that whoever went, it was someone who is least important to me at that point in the game, someone who could benefit me based on the current situation in the game. The person I always sent home was the person who had the littlest value to me at that juncture in the game. And I always just kind of shrunk it down from there. So be honest, have a plan. Don't just go off your gut. Develop a strategy based on the people you see in there. Present it in a way that sounds advantageous to everyone who's part of it. And stick to that. And if you stick to it and don't second guess yourself, you got it. You got a good shot.
All right. Thank you so much, Derek. This is great.
All right, Taryn. Thanks for having me, bud.
We're going to see in season 17, there's an attempt at a large secret alliance, but there's no real onion structure to it. And so it crumbles and it falls apart. In season 18, we're going to see an attempt made by somebody who knew Derek and got a little bit of advice from Derek, and it did have something there. There was something there to it. It was a little bit tighter. Unfortunately, this player was a bit too aggressive and was not able to keep everyone happy. And so, the onion crumbles, the onion structure crumbled and he lost it. But that was a good attempt. We then see in season 19, a returning player. In fact, a player that was in that attempt in season 18, come back and essentially recreate the bomb squad. What Paul is able to do there in season 19 is the structure isn't as nicely laid out with names and everything, but he essentially does the same thing. He creates a big mega alliance that's kind of a secret. He then has an onion structure within that, and he works individually on people throughout. And then as the onion starts to peel off the layers, Paul maintains control and he makes it all the way to the end. Now, again, he didn't win, but that's another podcast. But we do see this successful implementation of it. I do still think that season 16 and the bomb squad remains the gold standard for it. But what Paul does here, definitely worth looking at as well in terms of successful implementation of this pinnacle of alliance structure. We then see season 20, a 6-person alliance, the level 6. They were a secret alliance that they had an onion structure to it. Very successful, not as successful as the bomb squad or anything like that, but super successful, even in a season where the entire rest of the house was in an alliance against them. They were not as capable of floating as an alliance as other groups were, like Paul's group or the bomb squad or the brigade, but they were able to do enough dividing and conquering, enough floating that they were able to slide by some key weeks that they needed in order to maintain control in the battle between two alliances. And that is what's going to allow them to successfully dominate Faute, their opposition. And then once they get to the end, the onion peels off in the way that Tyler, who was really in charge of the structure, wanted it to. Again, he ends up losing in the end. Again, it's another podcast. And then, of course, in season 21, we see an attempt made with Grateful, a large 8-person secret alliance. That one is not properly structured. We see Tommy attempt to structure it in the way that he needs to, but he is not able to keep hold of the reins. Christy is going to attempt to take control as well. She is also going to fail to keep control of the reins of that alliance, and it's going to crumble, and it's not going to be a successful secret alliance. They did not do a great job of dividing and conquering either. I don't think they fully understood the structure well enough to implement it well enough, and so it's not going to work out super well for them. And that's basically where we are in Big Brother US history. Now, there are some Canadian examples as well. In season 2 of Big Brother Canada, there was the First Five Alliance. They were the first 5 people in the house. They essentially attempted to do what the Elite 8 attempted to do in season 4, where the first people in the house make a pact, stick together. They did divide and conquer. They were doing very well until a twist came along and kind of expedited their demise. And then, of course, in season 7 of Big Brother Canada, we see what is essentially the Brigade 2.0, a group of 4 guys who came together very early, made a pact to stick together. They divided, they conquered, and they did exactly what the Brigade did and replicated their success exactly. So again, we see an example of this structure being very, very effective when implemented correctly. It's interesting stuff. I think one of the main conclusions here that we can reach is that a lot of these basic building blocks were present very early on, but it really did take a long time to put all of these pieces together. Danielle and Jason were revolutionary in combining the elements in their favor in a way that was very effective and in a way that most people weren't able to replicate for a long time. But after that, we saw attempts at iteration. We saw attempts at development, and a lot of them didn't work out. We saw baby steps from that point forward until we finally reached these, you know, major breakthroughs in the Brigade, in the Bomb Squad. And now the Bomb Squad does remain the pinnacle. I think we haven't found a better structure for alliances, and I'm not sure there will be a better structure for alliances, for as long as the game remains how it is. The Bomb Squad structure is something that is very difficult to implement, but if you are able to, it is exceedingly dominant. In the 5 US seasons since the Bomb Squad happened, we've seen at least 3 attempts at recreating it, and only one of those attempts has succeeded. So it's very interesting to see that this might be where we are at. This might be the top level, and it's just a matter of making that mark, of succeeding at the implementation of this particular structure. That's going to help you win the game. Or maybe there is something else. Maybe there is something higher, something more effective than what we have now. What we've seen to make this structure to this point is all of those building blocks that were present very early on combined in a particular way. So I'm not sure where we would go from here. What building blocks are left to us that haven't already been implemented into this structure? I don't know. Maybe you know. Maybe you have an idea. Maybe you'll go on the show and maybe you will be the person who implements the next version, the new pinnacle of alliance structure. And I'll have to do an update podcast. So let me know what you think. Let me know if you enjoyed this. If you want more of this kind of thing, like I said, there will definitely be some ranking podcasts, some panels, some there'll be guests and all sorts of different things that will be coming your way with this podcast. So let me know what you think. If you want to hear more from me, you can find me on Twitter at Armstrong Taren. You can find me on Twitch streaming, twitch.tv/Taren Armstrong. I talk about all sorts of things on there. So you can always just pop on there and ask me a question if you want. If you're interested in rewatching some of these old seasons, we have recorded audiobooks for Big Brother 2 and 3 that are available for purchase, and we will be releasing an audiobook weekly now for free for Big Brother 4 in these quarantine times for you to listen to a special for you. So we will be doing that Big Brother 4 rewatch blockumentary weekly here in the as we approach the summer of 2020, if you want to check that out. So check all of that out. Thank you so much for joining me, and see you next time.